Welcome to another episode of the Religious Studies Project. I am here, I'm Christopher Cotter, I am here with David Robertson.
Hi, and we are lucky to be joined by the third editor of the Religious Studies Project, Louise Conroy.
Hello.
Hooray. Yeah, we finally managed to lure her out of her office for a little while.
Yes, well, we're drinking, we're back in the Wash Bar. You know, I'm sorry, listeners, we are in the same pub that we've been in before. It's a Friday. Normally we don't record on Fridays.
It's a bank holiday as well.
Yeah, busy times. David and I are drinking William's Joker IPA, and Louise is on a bottle of Corona and Lime. Without further ado, this week is the Bruno Latour week. We've told you a lot about it, but David, do you just want to set up what's happening this week?
I don't want to say too much more about what's in the interview, other than to say that we've broken it into two parts. Today we're talking mostly about his initial career path and how his work, his broader work relates to religious studies, and then later in the week we'll have the second part, which talks more specifically about the Gifford lectures.
So without further ado, let's just get on to Bruno Latour.
I'm pleased to be joined today by Professor Bruno Latour, who is professor at Sciences Po in Paris, has previously been professor at the École Nationale Supérieure de Mines in Paris, and a visiting professor in the University of California in San Diego and the London School of Economics and Harvard University. So a great pleasure to be talking to you today, and welcome to the Religious Studies Project. He began his work as an anthropologist of science, but his work has broadened over the years to take in aspects of sociology, moving increasingly into looking at subjects of religion and politics more broadly. His recent books, We Have Never Been Modern, On the Cult of the Factish Gods, and his forthcoming Rejoice, to be published by Polity Press later this year, represent a movement from this anthropology of science towards looking at religion, which has culminated with this year's Gifford lecture series on the subject of Gaia and natural religion. But we'll get to that in time. What I'd like to do with this interview is to do two things. One, to introduce your work to the religious studies community and outline how your ideas could be utilised by it, because I don't think your ideas are well known enough in this field. But whilst doing that, is to look at your career from anthropologist of science to this leading theological lecture series, started in 1888, of course. I thought the best place to start might be to ask you to briefly outline the actor network theory, which was the subject that brought you to the attention of the Academy for the first time.
Well, actually, the perspective that you presented is slightly inaccurate, because I started in religious studies before, before I entered into anthropology of science. So the perspective is actually reversed, that because of the work I did in religious studies when I did my PhD in exegesis, in around biblical exegesis.
I did not know that.
But I was actually then transported, because of anthropology in Africa, and then later in California, to compare types of exegesis, so to speak.
Ah, okay.
So the scientific exegesis in the skills I'd learned, which is the interest for texts, for the complexity of interpretation, was sort of shifted quite nicely from the study of the biblical exegesis to the study of science, which I took as a, in the positive sense, as an exegetic task. So the the perspective is slightly different because my first work, so to speak, I mean, it's a PhD work, it's a research work, waiting, and was already interested in exactly the same thing that one I'm publishing now with Rejoicing.
Okay.
So it has been a long-term project, out of which the comparison between the various truth conditions and has grown. So then I studied also law and technology and other things, but the beginning of my interest was on exegesis.
I see. So then how did you then get to presenting the actor network theory then?
Actor network theory is a simplification for the sociologist, so to speak, of a set of arguments which has been developed in the anthropology, which started with religion, then science, then technology, then law, then economics, which is an interest in the type of association and a great doubt about what the social was supposed to be made of.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, the actor network theory also is part of an argument about science and the way science developed and technology developed, but also about on my dissatisfaction with religion, the critique of religion as it was understood at the time in a very, of course, secular mood in France in the 60s. So actor network theory is even though it took a life of its own,
mm-hmm.
because of the debates, which seem now to be completely moot, but at the time seemed to be very important for sociologists, about the link between human and non-human, which now, of course, is completely obvious with these things around the Anthropocene and all these things I'm doing now.
Yeah.
But at the time, sociologists were still obsessed by sort of old humanist position that when you are interested in the social, you have to fight against naturalism and against objectification, reification, and all those terms of the 60s and,
uh-huh,
and 70s,
uh-huh.
which is the Frankfurt School, the whole critique mood, so to speak. So actor network theory developed, because of lots of those polemics around the idea that you should, on the contrary, be able to follow association wherever they lead you,
yeah.
including leading you in question of ontology, which had been nicely and rather prematurely cut by sociologists. So that's why, in the back of my mind from the very beginning, the idea that we had to tackle ontological questions about all those beings with which we were associated.
Mm-hmm.
I've developed these two parallel projects. One is the actor network theory, which is a simplified version, let's say, in terms of association, essentially, but which had the advantage of opening already lots of connection. And another one, which is now published as a book soon at Harvard, on inquiry into modes of existence, which is entirely on the ontology of those different associations.
Mm-hmm.
So the perspective is slightly different, because for me, Rejoicing, which is a translation of a book which was published 10 years ago in French, is actually the first I should have written 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Because that's really the beginning of my project. So there's a sort of reverse order in the way people can absorb these arguments. But the main point is that actor network develops a type of follow-up of associations, and these questions around mode of existence define the ontology of those modes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the same problem, but seen in two different sort of lighting.
It's not dissimilar, I think, to the phenomenological method that we tend to use quite a lot in religious studies, or put more simply, sort of methodological agnosticism, where actor network theory, you are you allow you don't allow your own epistemic ideas to affect when you're analysing the relationship between the humans and other types of entities. Is that right? Or am I completely...
I'm not a great believer in difference.
Yeah.
No, in agnosticism, so I don't understand the question, I'm sure.
I'm not sure I do either, don't worry about it.
Phenomenology was, in all of this thing, the actor network and mode of existence project, rather the enemy, sort of completely obsessed by the object-subject distinction, even though they claim to overcome it by the epochy type of situation.
Yeah.
In fact, it had no result, so to speak, in following what science and technology said in it. Maybe you could say that in religious studies it was slightly less unproductive because it at least let some of the people speak about this experience.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a slightly less deleterious effect, probably in religious studies, than elsewhere. But still, it's very far from an ontology. It actually fights against the notion of ontology. So,
yes.
So it was very dissatisfying, and the whole project is to get out completely as out as possible.
My friends of mine who are great proponents of the phenomenological method, I argue with them quite a lot, because to me the problem is that it as you said there, it doesn't break it proposes this kind of other realm that you're somehow accessing, this ontic kind of, you know, it predisposes this irreductible religious experience, and what you're doing is using these techniques, you know, epoche and whatever, to be able to compare them to other sets of beliefs. But behind it all, there's this kind of, you know, far distant religious experience that you can't really access otherwise. All you can do is compare it and talk to other things. I've always had a problem with that.
It's frightened. A phenomenology is frightened by objectivity of science. And I'm not. Because we studied it. And we develop tools to study objectivity of science. So the objectivity of religion for us is something which is completely understandable. And we can study, of course, with the same reason in both cases. There's nothing especially irrational or specific. It's just a completely different ways of listening to beings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it's not the same set of rational and cognitive skills that we put to study anything and listen to anything. It's there, the same ear, the same eyes, the same mouth, the same body. It's just that the beings are different.
Mm-hmm.
So it's completely reversed from everything which has been proposed by phenomenology, which accepted the situation that was given to them by naturalism, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It just tried to delineate a little sort of protected department where you could were allowed to have other experience than the one we imagined was the objective experience of science. But of course, it had no connection either with science. So the flight out of objectivity was entirely based on a certain idea of objectivity, which we have shown in science to be being wrong. So that's why it opens so many different new ways of analyzing anything, including religion, of course. Because we take seriously the fact that people are encountered by beings, and not just themselves, but an experience of things which are not there, which is basically what critical religion would constantly insist upon.
Or the alternative in a lot of more sort of theologically inspired religious studies is to set up that kind of oppositional, where religious studies is about studying the sacred realm that science cannot access, right? So you set up this dichotomy between the sacred and the profane, I wondered, given your rejection of, you know, the subject-object divide, what you thought of this kind of sacred-profane dichotomy.
Well, it's actually, it mixes up so many different categories that it's difficult to get out of that. I mean, there is a natural, supernatural, which is a double red herring, because one is the natural, and also the supernatural, which is lodged upon us, which is even almost as bad, even worse, actually. So that's the first notion. Then there is a question of paganism, which is another red herring, which is the thing I'm trying to get in the factis book, which is the fight against idolatry, which is a misreading of, in my view, the Second Commandment, and a sort of very funny, sort of, not so funny, but it's a deviation, so to speak, of the definition of what it is to build idols or fetishes.
Yeah.
Which has, of course, deprived Christianity, at least, not necessarily other religion, but Christianity, of a lot of resources. Because they, not of course in the old days, but since the scientific revolution, which is always a moment when religious study is created as a field, of course, I mean, as a question, which itself is a problem. Then it means that you compare religion. And from where you compare religion?
Yeah.
Is there a place where you can compare religion? This is very odd. Now you can compare modes of existence, but comparing religion is a tricky business. It's usually set a comparison horizon somewhere, usually in the social. So this is one of the reasons why the notion of social is so was criticized by Acton as well.
Of course, I suspect. Well, I more than suspect. In the early days of religious studies, the thing that they were comparing religions to was Christianity, usually with some sort of hierarchical aspect to it.
The idea that there is a common thread and field to all religion, including Asian religion, fetishism, totemism, all these things, and Christianity is, of course, a militant idea from the 18th century. I don't think you can really reuse any of those things, except in a very, very, very general sense, where usually it means maybe something around the sacred, but that would be itself a dubious category, because a large part of those religions, which we call Christians, have a very different view of the sacred to begin with, and actually even that might be already a category mistake in their fight against other religions. So these categories are too vast. I think it's much more interesting to try to extract the adverb in all of this, which is what it is to speak religiously.
Yeah,
and the adverb has characters which is, in my view, susceptible of a precise definition, where the substantive talking about religion has not.
Well, let's have a look at Rejoicing then, because although that's the next book that will be coming out, that the, you know, your English speaking readers will get to read. As you said, it was published in France in 2002. Is that right?
All right.
So it's. It's quite different from your other books, I think, in that it comes across as it, and self-consciously, I think you know this, it comes across almost like a lecture from the pulpit.
A sermon,
exactly. Yeah, and it's very much concerned with this idea of to speak. Can we speak religiously? You tell us your own what your aims were with the book, and then there's a couple of specific questions I want to ask after that. What were you aiming for with this book? What was the intention?
Oh, yeah. I mean, for me, it's not different from the other book. It's just different because the topic is different. But it's the same interest in extracting the truth and falsity condition, the felicity and unfelicity condition. So for me, it's the same thing as the book I did on technology, the book I did on science, the book I did on law, which of course is different because the motive is different and the side is different. But it is a way, it is, for me, it's a, even though it looks like a more personal book, it's actually more scientific in my view, because it produces the object by the way it's talked about, which is supposed to analyze. Mm-hmm. So for me, it's it is a scientific book. It might definition of scientific, but it is, you produce a phenomenon that you are supposed to analyze. This is why the tone which I've chosen, and even the layout, which is flow inside which you enter and then you leave without interruption.
Yeah.
In the French version, it was actually started, the text started with the first page and ended up on the dust cover. which is about trying precisely to prove this adverb in lieu of a substantive. And in a tradition, which is of course one the Christian tradition, and then a sort of Bultmann, Bonhoeffer, I would think you would say existentialist definition of Christianity, which is of course has a lot of limits because it doesn't carry a lot of other things which could have been carried in the movement. In the, one of the lectures, before lectures, we had this discussion. What is the religion of a person who speaks in that tone? Is he evangelical? Is he Presbyterian or Anglican or whatever? Yeah. And I would, or Catholic. I would be, it would be difficult for me to say. But because what I'm, I try to explore is this, the rarity of this way of talking. So, that's why I'm interested in religious studies, why it's so rare to hear things being said that produce the phenomenon that of which we are talking about. As soon as it becomes a study of a referential, that is pointing out at a phenomenon which is not the phenomenon that you're actually extracting from reality, it becomes a lie. Or at least it becomes uninteresting and like so many religious talks. So I'm technically it would mean that, empirically it would mean that to be able to capture in sermons and preachers and gestures and that sort of thing, the difference between the adverb and the well-meaning moralistic or theological tone, which is unbearable and which has ruined religion.
Yeah.
At least Christian religion in our basically since the scientific revolution.
Yeah.
So this is why, for me, it's a quite important issue.
There was there's a couple of very interesting points, some of which are almost made in passing, which I think reading your other works kind of illuminates a little bit. But I was particularly one that particularly struck me was on page 6. You wrote, if we really wanted to translate in today's vocabulary what people once used to talk about when they uttered the word God, we'd have to look not at some new being we could substitute for him, but rather to whatever it is that gives everybody else the same feeling of indisputable familiarity. For most of our contemporaries, expressions such as the non-existence of God, the banality of the world, indifferent matter, market consumerism would be good synonyms, since what they would refer to would thereby be the same obviousness, the same everyday reality, the same solid backing. Now, this is something I've been sort of thinking myself for a long time and haven't had much luck persuading people about that, you know, when we're talking about there's so many people who say, I'm not religious at all, and then they'll be utterly affected by a football team winning, or they'll get a swell of pride when, you know, some junior member of the royal family marries, or some sort of, you know, or when Britain wins in the Olympic Games, and they don't seem to realise that they're behaving religiously or acting religiously just as much as if they were, you know, referring to God or something in a church. more so, in fact, perhaps because it's alive and spontaneous.
But being enthusiastic about the royal family is not necessarily being religious in the sense of the. I mean, maybe in England, I don't know, I know it's fine. Anyway, what counts is the extreme difficulty of. And the extreme simplicity, which is what the great beauty of this argument, which is one gospel as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's nothing simpler than this, what has been extracted from many ways in which beings can be addressed. This very specific one, which is that the time is achieved. The time has come to an end in the sense that the goal has been fulfilled. This is the end. Kingdom of God is there. So the word can vary, but the realization of the end is what makes these ways of talking so original in the many, many ways in which, in general, we mind our business.
Is that sort of binding of time? Is that there's a bit about that?
I mean, not how you define it, but I mean, the logos there. You are no longer moving your head. But of course, it's in time. So this is a great. All of the theology and all of the rituals and all of the inventiveness of this constant thread and flows of reinterpretation, which I've tried to sort of add a little minuscule segment, is about this understanding of this paradox that it's in time and end of time, eternity, which is called incarnation technically, but when you say that, it doesn't do anything. So when the problem is how do you do it? It's a truth condition which is entirely in the act of preaching it. That's why it's all in deeds, so to speak. And the immense accumulation of commentaries on these deeds is actually not as good as the deeds. Mm-hmm. And that again is reflexively specified in endless numbers of texts. I mean, starting with St. Paul, of course. If you don't have a charity, etc. So it all of that is extremely simple to understand, but it made it extraordinarily complex to understand because it has been completely and constantly subverted into an argument about belief.
Yes.
So belief has completely crushed all of this nap, all of these not nap, but all these layers, flows of constant reason.
Yeah.
And which has paradise. And when, of course, just at the time when these things were beginning to work, and when the science arrived and developed in its own, and for its own political reason, after the religious war, in the beginning of 17th century, then the science was quashed into objectivity and all this nonsense about naturalism. And on that religion was, I mean, sort of post-Redemptine, post-Reformation in Protestantism, as well in Catholicism, never recovered it. Into what? And that's where the Gifford arrived. Because the Gifford has been created a century later, because of Darwin and all of these things, to try to recover a little feeling that there was a problem. But of course, in a very dead alley, which is natural religion, which they try to resurrect every once in a while, but which is, there's too many things in natural and too many things in religion to be salvageable.
Yeah. Well,
so all of that is a sad story.
Indeed.
So you've just been listening to Bruno Latour. I hope you found it interesting, and thank you for listening. I'd like to pass over some final comments from David.
In terms of this, I'll wait till the second part goes out.
Yeah. Okay. But the second part of the interview coming out on Wednesday is the plan, which is the on the topic of Bruno Latour's Gifford Lectures.
Yeah, and now the Gifford Lectures are now all available online through the university's website. If you...
ed.ac.uk.
Yes, and if you Google Latour Gifford or something like that, I'm sure it'll come up. We'll put the link on the page anyway.
So that's 6 hours. So we've got half an hour of an introduction to the topic. So, wait for our podcast on Wednesday and then see if you want to listen to the full 6 hours.
Yes, and extra prizes for anybody pointing out the questions that people asked during those lectures that the Religious Studies Project would never have asked.
Yeah. So we've got a little bit of news for you. Just now, Louise, do you want to kick us off with some news?
So we've met tonight to look at the posters. Those posters will be included in the conference packs at Softcore. But what we'd be really keen for people to do as well is download the latest poster from the website and distribute them to their departments, put them up on notice boards, email them out to colleagues, etc. Again, it just helps us widen our sort of collaboration with this project.
Yeah.
And also flag up as well, I think, for the Ops Digest. I think it's really useful if we actually get some input from people. So every week we have an Ops Digest that goes out on a Friday, and it'd be great if people could email the Ops Digest email address with any suggestions for conferences, new books, jobs, etc. And it just widens our pool of information as well. So that's a plea from me, actually.
Yeah,
so,
and that email address is?
It's opsdigest@religiousstudiesproject.com.
OPPS.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you'll find all the information on our website and the new poster.
Yeah, and that'll be fantastic. So we'll be disseminating those posters at Socro. All the things that we're doing, we've confirmed a few participants for a roundtable discussion. We have finalised our panel session, the first Religious Studies Project panel session on religion in the news with Professor Emeritus Eileen Barker of Inform. So she is acting as an academic who has been liaising with the media in a professional capacity for decades, bridging the gap between academia and the public. We've got Dr. Tim Hutchings, who has been studying religion and the media from the outside. We have Christopher Landau, who is doing a PhD at Oxford, but he's part of our panel as a contributor to the book Religion in the News, but he's also a former BBC religion correspondent.
Well, wouldn't it be great if we could also have somebody who was a religious practitioner who was used to dealing with inquiries from the media?
Yeah, and you know what we managed to do?
What?
Dr. David Wilson. So not only academic, so part of the same discourse, as it were, but he's been a president of the Scottish... I'm going to say Scottish Spiritualist Association, but I might be wrong.
Might be a society, but it's one of the two.
But he's a practitioner who has engaged with the media in that capacity on a number of occasions.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, it sounds great.
The other thing that we've got is an interview with...
Drumroll, please. Martin Stringer. Now, Martin Stringer's book...
Contemporary Western Ethnography and
the definition of religion, despite the title, is, I think, one of the most important books in religious studies in the last 10 years. And I don't say that lightly. The reason I criticise the title is not the title per se, it's just it doesn't really sell what I think is good about the book. The thing that's good about the book is situational belief. And his, and not only his conceptualization of it, but the data that he uses to support it, I think is a very important contribution to religious studies and completely in keeping with a lot of other debates. David Morgan's material religion, Marion Bowman's work on popular spirituality and so on and so forth. If I was his publisher, which I'm not, I would reissue that book as Situational Belief, colon, and then all the other stuff.
Because it doesn't have a colon.
It doesn't have a colon. Academic books, I thought, had to have a colon. I thought that was part of the was part of the deal.
It's not the same as PhD thesis titles.
Indeed, yeah.
Exactly.
PhD theses, colon. Why they need colons.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
Yeah. So for now, let's leave you from the Wash Bar in Edinburgh with the plea to check out our Twitter, check out our Facebook, email us, check out our website, comment on our website, go to our iTunes, buy through our Amazon affiliates link, and
thanks for listening.